Side is, will this help Peter stay alive? Indirectly, this might not. What happens in training is highly secretive, so there's no point in taking action against me when no one will know what my transgression was. In fact, last year I was rewarded for my brashness. This is a different sort of crime, though. If the game makers are angry with me and decide to punish me in the arena, Peter could get caught up in the attack as well. Maybe it was too impulsive. Still, I can't say I'm sorry I did it. As we all gather for dinner, I notice Peter's hands are faintly stained with a variety of colors, even though his hair is still damp from bathing. He must have done some sort of camouflage after all. Once the soup is served, Haymitch gets right to the issue on everyone's mind.
All right, so how did your private sessions go?
I exchange a look with Peter. Somehow, I'm not that eager to put what I did into words. In the calm of the dining room, it seems very extreme. You first, I say to him. It must have been really special. I had to wait 40 minutes to go in. Peter seems to be stuck with the same reluctance I'm experiencing.
Well, I did the camouflage thing, like you suggested, Katniss.
He hesitates. Not exactly camouflage. I mean, I used the dyes.
To do what? Asks Portia.
I think of how ruffled the game makers were when I entered the gym for my session. The smell of cleaners, the mat pulled over that spot in the center of the gym. Was it to conceal something they were unable to wash away?
You painted something, didn't you? A picture.
Did you see it? Peter asks.
No, but they'd made a real point of covering it up, I say.
Well, that would be standard. They can't let one tribute know what another did, says Effie, unconcerned.
What did you paint, Peter?
She looks a little misty.
Was it a picture of Katniss?
Why would he paint a picture of me, Effie? I ask, somehow annoyed.
To show he's going to do everything he can to defend you. That's what everyone in the capital's expecting anyway. Didn't he volunteer to go in with you?
Effie says, as if it's the most obvious thing in the world. Actually, I painted a picture of Rue, Peter says, how she looked after Katniss had covered her in flowers. There's a long pause at the table while everyone absorbs this.
And what exactly were you trying to accomplish?
Haymitch asks, in a very measured voice.
I'm not sure. I just wanted to hold them accountable, if only for a moment, says Peter,
for killing that little girl.
This is dreadful.
Effie sounds like she's about to cry.
That sort of thinking, it's forbidden, Peter. Absolutely. You'll only bring down more trouble on yourself and Katniss.
I have to agree with Effie on this one, says Haymitch.
Portia and Cinna remain silent, but their faces are very serious. Of course, they're right, but even though it worries me, I think what he did was amazing.
I guess this is a bad time to mention I hung a dummy and painted Seneca Crane's name on it, I say.
This has the desired effect. After a moment of disbelief, all the disapproval in the room hits me like a ton of bricks.
You hung Seneca Crane? Says Cinna.
Yes, I was showing off my new knot-tying skills, and he somehow ended up at the end of the noose, I say.
Oh, Katniss, says Effie in a hushed voice. How do you even know about that?
Is it a secret? President Snow didn't act like it was. In fact, he seemed eager for me to know, I say. Effie leaves the table with her napkin pressed to her face.
Now I've upset Effie. I should have lied and said I shot some arrows.
You'd have thought we planned it, says Peter,
giving me just a hint of a smile.
Didn't you? Asks Portia, Her fingers press her eyelids closed as if she's warding off a very bright light.
No, I say, looking at Peter with a new sense of appreciation. Neither of us even knew what we were going to do before we went in.
And Haymitch, says Peter, we decided we don't want any other allies in the arena.
Good, then I won't be responsible for you killing off any of my friends with your stupidity, he says.
That's just what we were thinking, I tell him.
We finish the meal in silence, but when we rise to go into the sitting room, Cinna puts his arm around me and gives me a squeeze.
Come on, and let's go get those training scores.
We gather around the television set, and a red-eyed Effie rejoins us. The tributes' faces come up, district by district, and their scores flash under their pictures. 1 through 12. Predictably high scores for Kashmir, Gloss, Brutus, Inabaria, and Finnick. Low to medium for the rest.
Have they ever given a 0? I ask.
No, but there's a first time for everything, Cinna answers.
And it turns out he's right, because when Peter and I each pull a 12, we make Hunger Games history. No one feels like celebrating, though.
Why did they do that? I ask.
So that the others will have no choice but to target you, says Haymitch flatly. Go to bed. I can't stand to look at either one of you.
Peter walks me down to my room in silence, but before he can say good night, I wrap my arms around him and rest my head against his chest. His hands slide up my back, and his cheek leans against my hair. I'm sorry if I made things worse, I say.
No worse than I did. Why did you do it, anyway? He says.
I don't know. To show them that I'm more than just a piece in their games, I say. He laughs a little, no doubt remembering the night before the games last year. We were on the roof, neither of us able to sleep. Peter had said something of the sort then, but I hadn't understood what he meant. Now I do.
Me too, he tells me. And I'm not saying I'm not going to try to get you home, I mean. But if I'm perfectly honest about it,
if you're perfectly honest about it, you think President Snow has probably given them direct orders to make sure we die in the arena anyway, I say.
It's crossed my mind, says Peter.
It's crossed my mind, too, repeatedly. But while I know I'll never leave that arena alive, I'm still holding on to the hope that Peter will. After all, he didn't pull out those berries, I did. No one has ever doubted that Peter's defiance was motivated by love, so maybe President Snow will prefer keeping him alive, crushed and heartbroken, as a living warning to others.
But even if that happens, everyone will know we've gone out fighting, right?
Peter asks. Everyone will, I reply. And for the first time, I distance myself from the personal tragedy that has consumed me since they announced the Quell. I remember the old man they shot in District 11, and Bonnie and Twill, and the rumored uprisings. Yes, everyone in the districts will be watching me to see how I handle this death sentence, this final act of President Snow's dominance. They will be looking for some sign that their battles have not been in vain. If I can make it clear that I'm still defying the Capitol right up to the end, the Capitol will have killed me, but not my spirit. What better way to give hope to the rebels? The beauty of this idea is that my decision to keep Peter alive at the expense of my own life is itself an act of defiance. A refusal to play the Hunger Games by the Capitol's rules. My private agenda dovetails completely with my public one. And if I really could save Peter in terms of a revolution, this would be ideal, because I will be more valuable dead. They can turn me into some kind of martyr for the cause and paint my face on banners
and it will do more to rally people than anything I could do if I was living. But Peter would be more valuable alive and tragic, because he will be able to turn his pain into words that will transform people. Peter would lose it if he knew I was thinking any of this, so I only say, so what should we do with our last few days? I just want to spend every possible minute of the rest of my life with you, Peter replies. Come on, then, I say, pulling him into my room. It feels like such a luxury, sleeping with Peter again. I didn't realize until now how starved I've been for human closeness, for the feel of him beside me in the darkness. I wish I hadn't wasted the last couple of nights shutting him out. I sink down into sleep, enveloped in his warmth, and when I open my eyes again, daylight streaming through the windows. No nightmares, he says. No nightmares, I confirm. You? None. I'd forgotten what a real night's sleep feels like, he says. We lie there for a while, in no rush to begin the day. Tomorrow night will be the televised interview, so today Effie and Hamet should be coaching us. More high heels and sarcastic comments, I think. But then the red-headed Avox girl comes in with a note from Effie saying that, given our recent tour, both she and Hamet have agreed we can handle ourselves adequately in public. The coaching sessions have been cancelled. Really? Says Peter, taking the note from my hand and examining it. Do you know what this means? We'll have the whole day to ourselves. It's too bad we can't go somewhere, I say wistfully. Who says we can't? He asks. The roof. We order a bunch of food, grab some blankets, and head up to the roof for a picnic. A day-long picnic in the flower garden that tinkles with wind chimes. We eat, we lie in the sun, I snap off hanging vines and use my newfound knowledge from training to practice knots and weave nets. Peter sketches me. We make up a game with the force field that surrounds the roof. One of us throws an apple into it, and the other person has to catch it. No one bothers us. By late afternoon, I lie with my head on Peter's lap, making a crown of flowers, while he fiddles with my hair, claiming he's practicing his knots. After a while, his hands go still. What? I ask. I wish I could freeze this moment, right here, right now, and live in it forever, he says. Usually this sort of comment, the kind that hints of his undying love for me, makes me feel guilty and awful. But I feel so warm and relaxed, and beyond worrying about a future I'll never have, I just let the word slip out. Okay. I can hear the smile in his voice. Then you'll allow it? I'll allow it, I say. His fingers go back to my hair and I doze off, but he rouses me to see the sunset. It's a spectacular yellow and orange blaze behind the skyline of the capital. I didn't think you'd want to miss it, he says. Thanks, I say, because I can count on my fingers the number of sunsets I have left, and I don't want to miss any of them. We don't go and join the others for dinner, and no one summons us. I'm glad. I'm tired of making everyone around me so miserable, says Peter. Everybody crying, or Hamish. He doesn't need to go on. We stay on the roof until bedtime, and then quietly slip down to my room without encountering anyone. The next morning, we're roused by my prep team. The sight of Peter and me sleeping together is too much for Octavia, because she bursts into tears right away. You remember what Cinna told us, Venia says fiercely. Octavia nods and goes out sobbing. Peter has to return to his room for prep, and I'm left alone with Venia and Flavius. The usual chatter has been suspended. In fact, There's little talk at all, other than to have me raise my chin or comment on a makeup technique. It's nearly lunch when I feel something dripping on my shoulder and turn to find Flavius, who's snipping away at my hair with silent tears running down his face. Venia gives him a look, and he gently sets the scissors on the table and leaves. Then it's just Venia, whose skin is so pale her tattoos appear to be leaping off it. Almost rigid with determination, she does my hair and nails and makeup, fingers flying swiftly to compensate for her absent teammates. The whole time, she avoids my gaze. It's only when Cinna shows up to approve me and dismiss her that she takes my hands, looks me straight in the eye, and says,
"We would all like you to know what a privilege it has been to make you look your best."
Then she hastens from the room. My prep team, my foolish, shallow, affectionate pets, with their obsessions with feathers and parties, nearly break my heart with their goodbye. It's certain from Venia's last words that we all know I won't be returning. Does the whole world know it, I wonder? I look at Cinna. He knows, certainly. But as he promised, there's no danger of tears from him. "So, what am I wearing tonight?" I ask, eyeing the garment bag that holds my dress. "President Snow put in the dress order himself," says Cinna. He unzips the bag, revealing one of the wedding dresses I wore for the photo shoot. Heavy white silk with a low neckline and tight waist and sleeves that fall from my wrists to the floor, and pearls. Everywhere pearls. Stitched into the dress and in ropes at my throat and forming the crown for the veil. Even though they announced the quarter quell the night of the photo shoot, people still voted for their favorite dress. And this was the winner. "The president says you're to wear it tonight. Our objections were ignored." I rub a bit of the silk between my fingers, trying to figure out President Snow's reasoning. I suppose, since I was the greatest offender, my pain and loss and humiliation should be in the brightest spotlight. This, he thinks, will make that clear. It's so barbaric, the president turning my bridal gown into my shroud, that the blow strikes home, leaving me with a dull ache inside. "Well, it'd be a shame to waste such a pretty dress," is all I say. Cinna helps me carefully into the gown. As it settles on my shoulders, they can't help giving a shrug of complaint. "Was it always this heavy?" I ask. I remember several of the dresses being dense, but this one feels like it weighs a ton. "I had to make some slight alterations because of the lighting," says Cinna. I nod, but I can't see what that has to do with anything. He decks me out in the shoes and the pearl jewelry and the veil, touches up my makeup, has me walk. "You're ravishing," he says. "Now, Katniss, because this bodice is so fitted, I don't want you raising your arms above your head. Well, not until you twirl, anyway." "Will I be twirling again?" I ask, thinking of my dress last year. "I'm sure Caesar will ask you, and if he doesn't, you suggest it yourself. Only, not right away. Save it for your big finale," Cinna instructs me. "You give me a signal, so I know when," I say. "All right. Any plans for your interview? I know Haymitch left you two to your own devices," he says. "No, this year I'm just winging it. The funny thing is, I'm not nervous at all." And I'm not. However much President Snow may hate me, this capital audience is mine. We meet up with Effie, Haymitch, Portia, and Peter at the elevator. Peter's in an elegant tuxedo and white gloves, the sort of thing grooms wear to get married in here in the capital. Back home, everything is so much simpler. A woman usually rents a white dress that's been worn hundreds of times. The man wears something clean that's not mining clothes. They fill out some forms at the justice building and are assigned a house. Family and friends gather for a meal or a bit of cake, if it can be afforded. Even if it can't, there's always a traditional song we sing as the new couple crosses the threshold of their home. And we have our own little ceremony, where they make their first fire, toast a bit of bread, and share it. Maybe it's old-fashioned, but no one really feels married in District 12 until after the toasting. The other tributes have already gathered off stage and are talking softly, but when Peter and I arrive, they fall silent. I realize everyone's staring daggers at my wedding dress. Are they jealous of its beauty, the power it might have to manipulate the crowd? Finally, Finnick says, "I can't believe Cinna put you in that thing." "He didn't have any choice. President Snow made him," I say, somewhat defensively. I won't let anyone criticize Cinna. Kashmir tosses her flowing blonde curls back and spits out, "Well, you look ridiculous." She grabs her brother's hand and pulls him into place to lead our procession onto the stage. The other tributes begin to line up as well. I'm confused because, while they all are angry, some are giving us sympathetic pats on the shoulder, and Joanna Mason actually stops to straighten my pearl necklace. "Make him pay for it, okay?" she says. I nod, but I don't know what she means. Not until we're all sitting out on stage and Caesar Flickerman, hair and face highlighted in lavender this year, has done his opening spiel and the tributes begin their interviews. This is the first time I realize the depth of betrayal felt among the victors and the rage that accompanies it. But they are so smart, so wonderfully smart about how they play it, because it all comes back to reflect on the government and President Snow in particular. Not everyone. There are the old throwbacks, like Brutus and Ina Baria, who are just here for another games, and those too baffled or drugged or lost to join in on the attack. But there are enough victors who still have the wits and the nerve to come out fighting. Kashmir starts the ball rolling with a speech about how she just can't stop crying when she thinks of how much the people in the capital must be suffering because they will lose us. Glass recalls the kindness shown here to him and his sister. Beatty questions the legality of the quell in his nervous, twitchy way, wondering if it's been fully examined by experts of late. Finnick recites a poem he wrote to his one true love in the capital, and about 100 people faint because they're sure he means them. By the time Joanna Mason gets up, she's asking if something can't be done about the situation. Surely the creators of the Quarter Quell never anticipated such love forming between the victors and the capital. No one could be so cruel as to sever such a deep bond. Cedar quietly ruminates about how, back in District 11, everyone assumes President Snow is all-powerful. So if he's all-powerful, why doesn't he change the quell? And Chaff, who comes right on her heels, insists the president could change the quell if he wanted to, but he must not think it matters much to anyone. By the time I'm introduced, the audience is an absolute wreck. People have been weeping and collapsing and even calling for change. The sight of me in my white silk bridal gown practically causes a riot. No more me. No more star-crossed lovers living happily ever after. No more wedding. I can see even Caesar's professionalism showing some cracks as he tries to quiet them so I can speak. but my 3 minutes are ticking quickly away. Finally, there's a lull, and he gets out,
"So, Katniss, obviously, this is a very emotional night for everyone. Is there anything you'd like to say?"
My voice trembles as I speak. "Only that I'm so sorry you won't get to be at my wedding. But I'm glad you at least get to see me in my dress. Isn't it just the most beautiful thing?"
I don't have to look at Cinna for a signal. I know this is the right time. I begin to twirl slowly, raising the sleeves of my heavy gown above my head. When I hear the screams of the crowd, I think it's because I must look stunning. Then I notice something is rising up around me. Smoke from fire. Not the flickery stuff I wore last year in the chariot, but something much more real that devours my dress. I begin to panic as the smoke thickens. Charred bits of black silk swirl into the air, and pearls clatter to the stage. Somehow I'm afraid to stop because my flesh doesn't seem to be burning, and I know Cinna must be behind whatever is happening. So I keep spinning and spinning. For a split second I'm gasping, completely engulfed in the strange flames. Then, all at once, the fire is gone. I slowly come to a stop, wondering if I'm naked and why Cinna has arranged to burn away my wedding dress. But I'm not naked. I'm in a dress of the exact design of my wedding dress, only it's the color of coal and made of tiny feathers. Wonderingly, I lift my long, flowing sleeves into the air, and that's when I see myself on the television screen. Clothed in black, except for the white patches on my sleeves. Or, should I say, my wings. Because Cinna has turned me into a mockingjay.
Chapter 18. I'm still smoldering a little, so it's with a tentative hand that Caesar reaches out to touch my headpiece. The white has burned away, leaving a smooth, fitted veil of black that drapes into the neckline of the dress in the back.
"Feathers," says Caesar. "You're like a bird."
"A mockingjay, I think," I say, giving my wings a small flap. "It's the bird on the pin I wear as a token." A shadow of recognition flickers across Caesar's face, and I can tell he knows that the mockingjay isn't just my token, that it's come to symbolize so much more, that what will be seen as a flashy costume change in the capital is resonating in an entirely different way throughout the districts. But he makes the best of it.
"Well, hats off to your stylist. I don't think anyone can argue that that's not the most spectacular thing we've ever seen in an interview. Cinna, I think you better take a bow."
Caesar gestures for Cinna to rise. He does, and makes a small, gracious bow. And suddenly I am so afraid for him. What has he done? Something terribly dangerous, an act of rebellion in itself. And he's done it for me. I remember his words.
"Don't worry. I always channel my emotions into my work. That way, I don't hurt anyone but myself."
And I'm afraid he has hurt himself beyond repair. The significance of my fiery transformation will not be lost on President Snow. The audience, who's been stunned into silence, breaks into wild applause. I can barely hear the buzzer that indicates that my 3 minutes are up. Caesar thanks me, and I go back to my seat, my dress now feeling lighter than air. As I pass Peeta, who's headed for his interview, he doesn't meet my eyes. I take my seat carefully, but aside from the puffs of smoke here and there, I seem unharmed, so I turn my attention to him. Caesar and Peter have been a natural team since they first appeared together a year ago. Their easy give-and-take, comic timing, and ability to segue into heart-wrenching moments, like Peter's confession of love for me, have made them a huge success with the audience. They effortlessly open with a few jokes about fires and feathers and overcooking poultry. But anyone can see that Peter is preoccupied, so Caesar directs the conversation right into the subject that's on everyone's minds.
So, Peter, what was it like when, after all you've been through, you found out about the Quell?
Asks Caesar.
I was in shock. I mean, one minute I'm seeing Katniss looking so beautiful in all these wedding gowns, and the next...
Peter trails off.
You realized there was never going to be a wedding?
Asks Caesar gently. Peter pauses for a long moment, as if deciding something. He looks out at the spellbound audience, then at the floor, then finally up at Caesar.
Caesar, do you think all our friends here can keep a secret?
An uncomfortable laugh emanates from the audience. What can he mean?
Keep a secret from who? Our whole world is watching.
I feel quite certain of it, says Caesar.
We're already married, says Peter quietly. The crowd reacts in astonishment, and I have to bury my face in the folds of my skirt so they can't see my confusion. Where on earth is he going with this?
But how can that be?
Asks Caesar. Oh, it's not an official marriage. We didn't go to the Justice Building or anything, but we have this marriage ritual in District 12. I don't know what it's like in the other districts, but there's this thing we do, says Peter, and he briefly describes the toasting.
Were your families there?
Asks Caesar. No, we didn't tell anyone, not even Haymitch. And Katniss's mother would never have approved. But you see, we knew if we were married in the capital, there wouldn't be a toasting, and neither of us really wanted to wait any longer. So one day, we just did it, Peter says. And to us, we're more married than any piece of paper or big party could make us.
So this was before the Quell, says Caesar.
Of course before the Quell. I'm sure we'd never have done it after we knew, says Peter, starting to get upset.
But who could have seen it coming?
No one.
We went through the games, we were victors, everyone seemed so thrilled to see us together, and then out of nowhere, I mean, how could we anticipate a thing like that?
You couldn't, Peter.
Caesar puts an arm around his shoulders.
As you say, no one could have.
But I have to confess, I'm glad you two had at least a few months of happiness together.
Enormous applause. As if encouraged, I look up from my feathers and let the audience see my tragic smile of thanks. The residual smoke from the feathers has made my eyes teary, which adds a very nice touch.
I'm not glad, says Peter. I wish we had waited until the whole thing was done officially.
This takes even Caesar aback.
Surely even a brief time is better than no time.
Maybe I'd think that too, Caesar, says Peter bitterly, if it weren't for the baby.
There. He's done it again. Dropped a bomb that wipes out the efforts of every tribute who came before him. Well, maybe not. Maybe this year he has only lit the fuse on a bomb that the victors themselves have been building, hoping someone would be able to detonate it, perhaps thinking it would be me in my bridal gown, not knowing how much I rely on Cinna's talents, whereas Peter needs nothing more than his wits. As the bomb explodes, it sends accusations of injustice and barbarism and cruelty flying out in every direction. Even the most capital-loving, games-hungry, blood-thirsty person out there can't ignore, at least for a moment, how horrific the whole thing is.
I am pregnant. The audience can't absorb the news right away,
It has to strike them and sink in and be confirmed by other voices before they begin to sound like a herd of wounded animals, moaning, shrieking, calling for help. And me? I know my face is projected in a tight close-up on the screen, but I don't make any effort to hide it, because for a moment, even I am working through what Peter has said. Isn't it the thing I dreaded most about the wedding, about the future, the loss of my children to the games? And it could be true now, couldn't it? If I hadn't spent my life building up layers of defenses until I recoil at even the suggestion of marriage or a family. Caesar can't rein in the crowd again. Not even when the buzzer sounds. Peter nods his goodbye and comes back to his seat without any more conversation. I can see Caesar's lips moving, but the place is in total chaos and I can't hear a word. Only the blast of the anthem, cranked up so loud I can feel it vibrating through my bones, lets us know where we stand in the program. I automatically rise, and as I do, I sense Peter reaching out for me. Tears run down his face as I take his hand. How real are the tears? Is this an acknowledgement that he has been stalked by the same fears that I have, that every victor has, every parent in every district in Panem? I look back to the crowd, but the faces of Rue's mother and father swim before my eyes. Their sorrow, their loss. I turn spontaneously to Chaff and offer my hand. I feel my fingers close around the stump that now completes his arm and hold fast. And then it happens. Up and down the row, the victors begin to join hands. Some right away, like the Morphlings, or Wyrus and Beatty. Others, unsure but caught up in the demands of those around them, like Brutus and Inabaria. By the time the anthem plays its final strains, all 24 of us stand in one unbroken line in what must be the first public show of unity among the districts since the dark days. You can see the realization of this as the screens begin to pop into blackness. It's too late, though. In the confusion, they didn't cut us off in time. Everyone has seen. There's disorder on the stage now, too, as the lights go out, and we're left to stumble back into the training center. I've lost hold of Chaff, but Peter guides me into an elevator. Finnick and Joanna try to join us, but a harried peacekeeper blocks their way, and we shoot upward alone. The moment we step off the elevator, Peter grips my shoulders. There isn't much time, so tell me, is there anything I have to apologize for? Nothing, I say. It was a big leap to take without my okay, but I'm just as glad I didn't know, didn't have time to second-guess him, to let any guilt over Gale detract from how I really feel about what Peter did, which is empowered. Somewhere very far off is a place called District 12, where my mother and sister and friends will have to deal with the fallout from this night. Just a brief hovercraft ride away is an arena where tomorrow, Peter and I and the other tributes will face our own form of punishment. But even if all of us meet terrible ends, something happened on that stage tonight that can't be undone. We victors staged our own uprising, and maybe, just maybe, the capital won't be able to contain this one. We wait for the others to return, but when the elevator opens, only Haymitch appears. It's madness out there. Everyone's been sent home, and they've canceled the recap of the interviews on television. Peter and I hurry to the window and try to make sense of the commotion far below us on the streets. What are they saying? Peter asks. Are they asking the president to stop the games?
I don't think they know themselves what to ask. The whole situation is unprecedented. Even the idea of opposing the capital's agenda is a source of confusion for the people here, says Haymitch. But there's no way Snow would cancel the games. You know that, right?
I do. Of course, he could never back down now. The only option left to him is to strike back, and strike back hard. The others went home? I ask.
They were ordered to. I don't know how much luck they're having getting through the mob, says Haymitch.
Then we'll never see Effie again, says Peter. We didn't see her on the morning of the games last year. You'll give her our thanks.
More than that, really make it special. It's Effie, after all, I say. Tell her how appreciative we are and how she was the best escort ever, and tell her we send our love.
For a while we just stand there in silence, delaying the inevitable. Then Haymitch says it.
I guess this is where we say our goodbyes as well.
Any last words of advice? Peter asks.
Stay alive, Haymitch says gruffly.
That's almost an old joke with us now. He gives us each a quick embrace, and I can tell it's all he can stand.
Go to bed. You need your rest.
I know I should say a whole bunch of things to Haymitch, but I can't think of anything he doesn't already know, really, and my throat is so tight I doubt anything would come out anyway. So, once again, I let Peter speak for us both.
You take care, Haymitch, he says.
We cross the room, but in the doorway, Haymitch's voice stops us.
Katniss, when you're in the arena, he begins, then he pauses.
He's scowling in a way that makes me sure I've already disappointed him.
What?
I ask defensively.
You just remember who the enemy is, Haymitch tells me. That's all. Now go on, get out of here.
We walk down the hallway. Peter wants to stop by his room to shower off the makeup and meet me in a few minutes, but I won't let him. I'm certain that if a door shuts between us, it will lock and I'll have to spend the night without him. Besides, I have a shower in my room. I refuse to let go of his hand.
Do we sleep?
I don't know. We spend the night holding each other, in some halfway land between dreams and waking, not talking, both afraid to disturb the other, in the hope that we'll be able to store up a few precious minutes of rest. Cinna and Portia arrive with the dawn, and I know Peter will have to go. Tributes enter the arena alone. He gives me a light kiss.
See you soon, he says.
See you soon, I answer.
Cinna, who will help dress me for the games, accompanies me to the roof. I'm about to mount the ladder to the hovercraft when I remember I didn't say goodbye to Portia.
I'll tell her, says Cinna.
The electric current freezes me in place on the ladder until the doctor injects the tracker into my left forearm. Now they will always be able to locate me in the arena. The hovercraft takes off, and I look out the windows until they black out. Cinna keeps pressing me to eat, and when that fails, to drink. I manage to keep sipping water, thinking of the days of dehydration that almost killed me last year, thinking of how I will need my strength to keep Peter alive. When we reach the launch room at the arena, I shower. Cinna braids my hair down my back and helps me dress over simple undergarments. This year's tribute outfit is a fitted blue jumpsuit made of very sheer material that zippers up the front. A 6-inch wide padded belt covered in shiny purple plastic, a pair of nylon shoes with rubber soles.
What do you think? I ask, holding the fabric out for Cinna to examine.
He frowns as he rubs the thin stuff between his fingers.
I don't know. It will offer little in the way of protection from cold or water.
Sun? I ask, picturing a burning sun over a barren desert.
Possibly. If it's been treated, he says.
Oh, I almost forgot this. He takes my gold Mockingjay pin from his pocket and fixes it to the jumpsuit. My dress was fantastic last night, I say.
Fantastic and reckless, but Cinna must know that. I thought you might like it, he says with a tight smile.
We sit, as we did last year, holding hands until the voice tells me to prepare for the launch. He walks me over to the circular metal plate and zips up the neck of my jumpsuit securely.
"Remember, girl on fire," he says, "I'm still betting on you."
He kisses my forehead and steps back as the glass cylinder slides down around me.
"Thank you," I say, although he probably can't hear me.
I lift my chin, holding my head high the way he always tells me to, and wait for the plate to rise. But it doesn't. And it still doesn't. I look at Cinna, raising my eyebrows for an explanation. He just gives his head a slight shake, as perplexed as I am. Why are they delaying this? Suddenly the door behind him bursts open, and three peacekeepers spring into the room. Two pin Cinna's arms behind him and cuff him, while the third hits him in the temple with such force he's knocked to his knees. But they keep hitting him with metal-studded gloves, opening gashes on his face and body. I'm screaming my head off, banging on the unyielding glass, trying to reach him. The peacekeepers ignore me completely as they drag Cinna's limp body from the room. All that's left are the smears of blood on the floor. Sickened and terrified, I feel the plate begin to rise. I'm still leaning against the glass when the breeze catches my hair and I force myself to straighten up. Just in time, too, because the glass is retreating and I'm standing free in the arena. Something seems to be wrong with my vision. The ground is too bright and shiny and keeps undulating. I squint down at my feet and see that my metal plate is surrounded by blue waves that lap up over my boots. Slowly, I raise my eyes and take in the water spreading out in every direction. I can only form one clear thought. This is no place for a girl on fire.
Part 3. The Enemy. Chapter 19.
"Ladies and gentlemen, let the 75th Hunger Games begin."
The voice of Claudius Templesmith, the Hunger Games announcer, hammers my ears. I have less than a minute to get my bearings. Then the gong will sound and the tributes will be free to move off their metal plates. But move where? I can't think straight. The image of Cinna, beaten and bloody, consumes me. Where is he now? What are they doing to him? Torturing him? Killing him? Turning him into an Avox? Obviously, his assault was staged to unhinge me, the same way Darius's presence in my quarters was. And it has unhinged me. All I want to do is collapse on my metal plate. But I can hardly do that after what I just witnessed. I must be strong. I owe it to Cinna, who risked everything by undermining President Snow and turning my bridal silk into mockingjay plumage. And I owe it to the rebels who, emboldened by Cinna's example, might be fighting to bring down the Capitol at this moment. My refusal to play the games on the Capitol's terms is to be my last act of rebellion, so I grit my teeth and will myself to be a player. "Where are you?" I can still make no sense of my surroundings. "Where are you?" I demand an answer from myself, and slowly the world comes into focus. Blue water, pink sky, white-hot sun beating down. All right, there's the cornucopia, the shining gold metal horn, about 40 yards away. At first it appears to be sitting on a circular island, but on closer examination, I see the thin strips of land radiating from the circle like the spokes on a wheel. I think there are 10 to 12, and they seem equidistant from one another. Between the spokes, all is water, water and a pair of tributes. That's it, then. There are 12 spokes, each with 2 tributes balanced on metal plates between them. The other tribute in my watery wedge is Old Woof from District 8. He's about as far to my right as the land strip on my left. Beyond the water, wherever you look, a narrow beach, and then dense greenery. I scan the circle of tributes, looking for Peter, but he must be blocked from my view by the cornucopia. I catch a handful of water as it washes in and smell it. Then I touch the tip of my wet finger to my tongue. As I suspected, it's salt water, just like the waves Peter and I encountered on our brief tour of the beach in District 4. But at least it seems clean. There are no boats, no ropes, not even a bit of driftwood to cling to. No, there's only one way to get to the cornucopia. When the gong sounds, I don't even hesitate before I dive to my left. It's a longer distance than I'm used to, and navigating the waves takes a little more skill than swimming across my quiet lake at home. But my body seems oddly light, and I cut through the water effortlessly. Maybe it's the salt. I pull myself, dripping, onto the land strip and sprint down the sandy stretch for the cornucopia. I can see no one else converging from my side, although the gold horn blocks a good portion of my view. I don't let the thought of adversaries slow me down, though. I'm thinking like a career now, and the first thing I want is to get my hands on a weapon. Last year, the supplies were spread out quite a distance around the cornucopia, with the most valuable closest to the horn. But this year, the booty seems to be piled at the 20-foot-high mouth. My eyes instantly home in on a golden bow just in arm's reach, and I yank it free. There's someone behind me. I'm alerted by, I don't know, a soft shift of sand, or maybe just a change in the air currents. I pull an arrow from the sheath that's still wedged in the pile and arm my bow as I turn. Finnick, glistening and gorgeous, stands a few yards away with a trident poised to attack. A net dangles from his other hand. He's smiling a little, but the muscles in his upper body are rigid in anticipation.
"You can swim, too," he says. "Where did you learn that in District 12?
"We have a big bathtub," I answer.
"You must," he says. "You like the arena?"
"Not particularly, but you should. They must have built it especially for you," I say with an edge of bitterness. It seems like it anyway, with all the water, when I bet only a handful of the victors can swim. And there was no pool in the training center, no chance to learn. Either you came in here a swimmer, or you'd better be a really fast learner. Even participation in the initial bloodbath depends on being able to cover 20 yards of water. That gives District 4 an enormous advantage. For a moment, we're frozen, sizing each other up. Our weapons, our skill. Then Finnick suddenly grins.
"Lucky thing we're allies, right?"
Sensing a trap, I'm about to let my arrow fly, hoping it finds his heart before the trident impales me, when he shifts his hand, and something on his wrist catches the sunlight. A solid gold bangle patterned with flames. The same one I remember on Haymitch's wrist the morning I began training. I briefly consider that Finnick could have stolen it to trick me, but somehow I know this isn't the case. Haymitch gave it to him, as a signal to me, an order, really, to trust Finnick. I can hear other footsteps approaching. I must decide at once. "Right," I snap, because even though Haymitch is my mentor and trying to keep me alive, this angers me. Why didn't he tell me he'd made this arrangement before? Probably because Peter and I had ruled out allies. Now Haymitch had chosen one on his own. "Duck!" Finnick commands in such a powerful voice, so different from his usual seductive purr, that I do. His trident goes whizzing over my head, and there's a sickening sound of impact as it finds its target. The man from District 5, the drunk who threw up on the sword-fighting floor, sinks to his knees as Finnick frees the trident from his chest.
"Don't trust 1 and 2, Finnick says.
There's no time to question this. I work the sheath of arrows free. "Each take one side," I say. He nods, and I dart around the pile. About 4 spokes apart, Inobara and Gloss are just reaching land. Either they're slow swimmers, or they thought the water might be laced with other dangers, which it might well be. Sometimes it's not good to consider too many scenarios, but now that they're on the sand, they'll be here in a matter of seconds.
Anything useful? I hear Finnick shout.
I quickly scan the pile on my side and find maces, swords, bows and arrows, tridents, knives, spears, axes, metallic objects I have no name for, and nothing else.
Weapons, I call back. Nothing but weapons.
Same here, he confirms. Grab what you want and let's go.
I shoot an arrow at Inobaria, who's gotten in too close for comfort, but she's expecting it and dives back into the water before it can find its mark. Gloss isn't quite as swift, and I sink an arrow into his calf as he plunges into the waves. I sling an extra bow and a second sheath of arrows over my body, slide two long knives and an awl into my belt, and meet up with Finnick at the front of the pile.
"Do something about that, would you?" he says.
I see Brutus barreling toward us. His belt is undone, and he has it stretched between his hands as a kind of shield. I shoot at him, and he manages to block the arrow with his belt before it can skewer his liver. Where it punctures the belt, a purple liquid spews forth, coating his face. As I reload, Brutus flattens on the ground, rolls the few feet to the water, and submerges. There's a clang of metal falling behind me.
Let's clear out, I say to Finnick.
This last altercation has given Inobaria and Gloss time to reach the cornucopia. Brutus is within shooting distance, and somewhere, certainly Kashmir, is nearby too. These four classic careers will no doubt have a prior alliance. If I had only my own safety to consider, I might be willing to take them on with Finnick by my side, but it's Peter I'm thinking about. I spot him now, still stranded on his metal plate. I take off, and Finnick follows without question, as if knowing this will be my next move. When I'm as close as I can get, I start removing knives from my belt, preparing to swim out to reach him and somehow bring him in. Finnick drops a hand on my shoulder.
I'll get him.
Suspicion flickers up inside me. Could this all just be a ruse? For Finnick to win my trust and then swim out and drown Peter?
I can, I insist. But Finnick has dropped all his weapons to the ground.
Better not exert yourself. Not in your condition,
he says, and reaches down and pats my abdomen.
Oh, right. I'm supposed to be pregnant, I think.
While I'm trying to think what that means and how I should act, maybe throw up or something, Finnick has positioned himself at the edge of the water.
Cover me, he says.
He disappears with a flawless dive.
I raise my bow, warding off any attackers from the cornucopia, but no one seems interested in pursuing us. Sure enough, Gloss, Kashmir, Inobaria, and Brutus have gathered, their pack formed already, picking over the weapons. A quick survey of the rest of the arena shows that most of the tributes are still trapped on their plates. Wait, no, there's someone standing on the spoke to my left, the one opposite Peter. It's Mags. But she neither heads for the cornucopia nor tries to flee. Instead, she splashes into the water and starts paddling toward me, her gray head bobbing above the waves. Well, she's old, but I guess after 80 years of living in District 4, she can keep afloat.
Finnick has reached Peter now and is towing him back, one arm across his chest while the other propels them through the water with easy strokes. Peter rides along without resisting. I don't know what Finnick said or did that convinced him to put his life in his hands, showed him the bangle, maybe. Or just the sight of me waiting might have been enough. When they reach the sand, I help haul Peter up onto dry land.
Hello again, he says, and gives me a kiss.
We've got allies.
Yes, just as Haymitch intended, I answer.
Remind me, did we make deals with anyone else? Peter asks.
Only Mags, I think, I say. I nod toward the old woman doggedly making her way toward us.
Well, I can't leave Mags behind, says Finnick.
She's one of the few people who actually likes me.
I've got no problem with Mags, I say, especially now that I see the arena. Her fishhooks are probably our best chance of getting a meal.
Katniss wanted her on the first day, says Peeta. Katniss has